Welcome back to Talkie Talk.
We're back, baby. Talkie Talk is back in action.
We are sitting in the derelict living room of my neighbor's empty house.
It's a beautiful house.
It's actually a lovely house. It's not
It's got a lot of maps. It's got secret passages.
And if you ever saw it, you would love it, but you won't because it's a secret. I've seen the videos of Tobey Maguire yelling at the paparazzi. I can't have people know where I live.
You can't risk it.
I don't want that to become me. Because I know that I'm fallible.
Bit of a demon. You've got two wolves inside of you.
There are. It's a lot like, you know, I just have so much power.
Speaking about movies, though, and the podcast, when I've been editing these last four episodes, which we recorded in 2021, and at the time, I looked at the files, and there was some bleed through in the mics, and I was like, I can't ever do this. This is ridiculous. And it doesn't take long at all. You just kind of cut out the echo. And that's really all you need to do. But listening back to them, I mean, some of it, I'm like, you know, that's actually a really good point. I never thought about it that way.
Shocking.
But other times I'm like, damn, I kind of fucked up there. Only a couple times. But what I really fucked up on is my rating for Old Boy. Because I gave that a 7.5.
Yeah, I was shocked you gave it a 7.5.
Yeah.
I remember you arguing against you a lot for that one, but
I mean, listening back to that, I was like,
I wasn't wrong.
I made some good points. I'm not going to lie. There were some plot holes, maybe. I feel like that not bothered me, but I was more critical of that the first time. Because when we watch it in the theater,
I was
just fucking blown away.
Yeah.
Revamp, like an 8.5 probably. It's so gorgeous.
It's such a great looking movie.
Especially in theaters too. It does change things to see it on the big screen.
Yeah.
But one other correction I have to issue. For our Nomadland podcast, I gave that a 6. I'd probably bring that down to a 4. Because I was listening to my own criticisms of it, and then I got to the 6, and I was like, what the fuck are you talking about? You gave it, I think, like a 2 or something, 2.5.
I think if I watched it again, since then, I've thought about it, and I was not in the mood for that type of movie. I think if I watched it again,
we were very harsh.
I think if I watched it again, I would probably maybe give it a little higher.
Yeah.
Like a 4 or 5.
100% stick by our Kong versus Godzilla podcast. It's a great movie.
We both loved it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what's so funny, though? I don't remember a single thing any human in that movie did.
No. I don't think we talked about, like, almost any of the human plot. Because I think as soon as we finished it, I couldn't remember what the human plot was.
Yeah.
I will say, let's extend our congratulations to Godzilla -1 for winning Best Special Effects.
Yeah.
I'm so happy.
I saw John Carpenter tweeted, and he was like, I can't believe a Godzilla movie won Special Effects in my lifetime.
That's so awesome. Unfortunately, we weren't back recording when we saw that, but I do want to say to the Talkie Talk Nation, that movie is incredible. That like might have been my number 2 or 3 for like last year of best movie. It's just like so sincere, incredible special effects, as was recognized, just great characters. It's just like I was like tearing up in the theater. I was hearing people sniffling, like it's, and the music, dude. Oh my God. When that theme comes in at the end, when they're finally confronting Godzilla,
yeah,
it's just get chills. Like it's, you can feel it in your whole body, which is like, I love when that happens.
I really like that it hit like the perfect sweet spot of like just archetypal enough.
Yep.
And it almost felt like how people say like Star Wars is more of like a fable than like
right.
a sci-fi. It was like that. It was like,
right.
It feels like a classical story.
Right.
And all these characters have depth. But it's not like a 4-hour character study on like
right.
the meaning behind Godzilla with like meta analysis and shit. It's like they're interesting characters. Maybe they're not the most profound that's ever been put to film, but they work. The depths to which they're explored and the way that they interact with each other are so effective for the story the film is telling.
Yeah.
It's really refreshing.
Yeah. And it makes me optimistic for like Hollywood, because they will, you know,
questionable.
Follow trends. I mean, it's whatever makes money, and that is the highest grossing Japanese film of all time, animated or live action.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So I think it's, and most of it was word of mouth, because it was supposed to be like a 7-day theatrical run in the US, I think. I think they extended it up to like 2 months because it was just doing so well, and everybody was talking about
yeah.
it.
Yeah, it's preferable.
When you see like those huge budgets for like Disney and stuff, this is for the listener, not Tyler, who's in the know. But when you see these huge budgets for movies, usually, I don't want to give an exact number, but maybe like even more than half is like advertising. We were talking about before this in our private conversations, we were talking about Boy and the Heron, which won animated best animated feature, which I think was very deserved. It had zero trailers because Miyazaki specifically was like, yeah, I don't want any promotion for this. They released a picture of the heron with like an eyeball poking out from its beak. And that's the only promotion they nice. Did. And it's his highest grossing movie and it won an award. Like reputation yeah. and word of mouth, like I think is becoming more important again because people are just getting used to this onslaught of advertisements for these corporate movies. And people are hungry for like good movies.
Yeah, I've never believed that kind of like apathetic thing of like the general audience likes vapid crap.
Yeah, I don't think it's true.
If you bring food to the table, they're going to eat it.
Yeah,
and right. And you're like, wow, it works when it's the only thing they're allowed to see.
Exactly, like, yeah. You make good movies more available and people, as we're seeing, go to see them
yeah.
and love them.
Yeah.
And they do well at the box office. So little yep. lesson for all of us in Hollywood, me included, to learn. So this week's movie, we watched Nadia, The Secret of Blue Water, the motion picture. This is the cinematic follow-up to Nadia, The Secret of Blue Water, the anime, which for those Evangelion fans out there, was Anno's series right before Eva, aired between 1990 and 1991. He had done Gunbuster just before this as well. Both great series. We watched the show together. It's a great show. I really loved it.
It's got a great 28 episodes. Some people act like, it's weird. Some people will say that there's more. I don't remember there being more. There's some arc people refer to as the Island Arc. I've never heard of that before.
It was originally planned as the prequel to Evangelion, or rather Evangelion was planned as the sequel to it. Wikipedia says that all 26 episodes had to be rewritten. I don't think that's true.
I can't imagine that was the case, but I also feel like Anno is like strange enough
yeah.
and a hard worker.
Yeah, but I did find a source from Tsurumaki, who is co-director on End of Eva, right? Yeah, it was Tsurumaki, and I think is one of the co-directors on the Rebuild series. But he had a quote talking about Nadia's connection. In the final episode, there's a scene where Gargoyle comes into contact with the light from the blue water and turns into a pillar of salt. And the initial proposal for Eva, the huge explosion that was caused in Antarctica, was instead an explosion at the Dead Sea. And it was called the Dead Sea Evaporation Incident. Yeah, there was an idea that it would possibly take place in a parallel world or be a continuation of Nadia. So you can see when you watch Nadia, there's a lot of yeah. ideas in there. And in the Rebuild 3.0, there's a lot taken from Nadia. Some of the main themes are from Nadia, the remixed versions. The theme for the new Nautilus is the theme for the Wunder. Oh, and some of the costumes and like the Wunder in general is designed after new Nautilus. And there are some like shot for shot comparisons between them, which is very cool. So Nadia, very good show. But as we were saying, it was kind of a mess in the halfway point. NHK requested more episodes because it was pretty popular. In the middle, they were outsourcing those episodes, like the animation, to Korea because it was cheaper, I believe. Okada says here, when Shinji Higuchi took over, he says, on Nadia, you had Higuchi saying, oh, I'll surprise Anno, hide, and change the screenplay. Screenplays and storyboards got changed when people went home, and the next morning, if no one could find the original, I authorized them to go ahead with the changes. So it got a little rough in the middle. It comes back with a fantastic conclusion. And yeah, I love it overall.
Didn't Anno leave for a little bit in the middle for the Island Arc? Or was he directing the whole time?
No, so Shinji Higuchi took over
okay.
through the series to the end. So he also directed the end episodes. Anno was still listed as like the chief director.
Okay.
But Higuchi was given more control of those later episodes.
The climax just before the Island Arc feels like a season one ending.
Yeah.
Like
definitely.
It just so much is like everything. It's so fucking crisp. Like yeah. everybody who, I mean, pretty much everybody. Because there are people out there who are like, oh, 40 episodes. I can't watch. You can.
It's awesome.
Just watch it.
Yeah.
It's really good.
Yeah.
It's like if you were watching a show, just imagine yourself watching a show and enjoying
yeah.
it. That's this.
Yeah.
That's the show.
That's Nadia.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think we're just going to do spoilers, right? Because this show is like 20 years old.
Yeah, we're going to have to do spoilers for this. I was thinking we could kind of skip over some of the particulars of the series plot and just kind of give the lead up to this movie.
Yeah, we're doing the movie, right?
Okay. Yeah.
I do want to say though, like I do actually think that this is a good series to recommend to people who aren't super into anime. There's like the classic, you know, the classic anime stuff of like peeking on changing women and stuff, which is, you know,
part of the culture.
We'll gloss over that, but
yeah,
but there is like, it's very similar to like Miyazaki's stuff. It's very Western in a lot of its art design. It's a classic like adventure globetrotting novel type thing, because it's based off of Jules Verne's work. And I think with that kind of like overt Western influence, it's very palatable to people who don't usually watch anime.
It's very different from a lot of series in such a good way. And yeah, as you were mentioning, it is loosely based on 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. So essentially, it follows Jean-Jacques Rautic, who is a 14-year-old inventor in France who is trying to make a flying machine with his uncle. And first episode, they enter in this flying machine competition. Also during that episode, he comes across Nadia, who is a 14-year-old circus performer who has a gem called the Blue Water. She's in pursuit by Grandis Granva and her two henchmen, Sanson and Hansen, and they are trying to steal the jewel from her. And he gets involved and helps her escape. Has this setup of like, okay, it's this villain trio, this like goofy villain trio with all this wild technology. They have this vehicle that they put commands into through a piano. Just all this, like, it's like Team Rocket vibes.
It's completely Team Rocket, which is crazy because, like, of all the, because this had the whole scandal with, like, people saying that Atlantis, the Disney Atlantis, plagiarized this.
Yeah. Dude,
Pokemon ripped that shit straight out of
absolutely.
This. There's no way. Grandis looks exactly like Jesse.
Yeah.
Like,
for
it's
sure.
crazy.
And they, every time that they escape, their vehicle gets fucked up and they go flying into the air.
Yep.
Like it's very much Team Rocket.
It does a really good job, like right off the bat, of just capturing that feeling of like a classical adventure.
So that's the setup. And then Nadia and Jean, I'll skip over some of this, but you know, they end up together trying to escape and they land on this island. They come across, first thing they come across is a family with the two parents slaughtered on the ground. And a young child next to them who's unconscious. They wake her up. This is Mari. She joins the crew. They take care of her. And they find out that a villain named Gargoyle and his like empire called Neo Atlantis is trying to take over the world. There's like this Atlantean race. He sees himself as the successor to them. And so he wants to take over humanity because he thinks the Atlanteans are like the rightful owners of the earth and superior to humanity. So they get wrapped up in this like dark turn. And as the events go on, what seemed like the original villain, they turn out to just be jewel thieves who are only interested in this magical jewel because they need money. Grandis turns out to be, she used to be like a daughter of a rich family.
She's like a debutante, yeah.
Yeah, she was scammed out of all of her money by her husband. Sanson and Hansen were her former help, like gardener and stuff like that. And they end up helping Nadia and Jean. And during all of this, they meet the crew of the Nautilus, led by Captain Nemo. And so the series, essentially, them and the crew versus Gargoyle and his empire. Then they go on an island for like 12 episodes and a lot of bullshit happens.
Nothing happens.
There's some good scenes in there. I wouldn't say it's skippable.
I would say the only part I think that are legitimately skippable, I think, is Africa and the last 10 seconds of the whole series. Other than that.
I wasn't going to even mention that. but eventually they are able to defeat Gargoyle. This is after the Nautilus, which is originally a submarine. They get a new Nautilus, which is a spaceship, which is really sick.
Let's go.
The comeback of the crew is so good because they're gone for the whole island arc. And when they come back, I think both of us were like, cheering.
Yeah, because we're finally out of that mess.
Yeah, and they come back with their new ship, and it's really cool. So, yeah, they're able to defeat it, and Nadia has turned out to be the secret princess of Atlantis.
Which nobody saw coming.
No, I had no idea, dude. I was wondering what the secret was the whole time. So, yeah, I mean, that's kind of how it concludes. Nadia has to give up her powers in order to save the day.
The first two-ish to three-ish arcs are so good.
Yeah.
So fantastically paced.
Tight. Yeah.
Really fun. But honestly, the way that they scale up the tone when Mary is introduced and her parents are just like, her whole village is like slaughtered by this like, you know, fascist military operation. Like, it's like they do a great job of just really being like, oh shit, like this is... this is not good.
Yeah, that episode is so good because even in the animation as well, Paris is all like, it looks like it's drawn like a picture book in Paris, and then they get into this darker phase and that changes, which is really great. Now let's move on to the movie. So here's the deal with the movie. A lot of this is from Takeda's book, the Notenki memoirs. He credits Nadia with creating like the Gainax fan base because it was in like a primetime slot on NHK and got them a lot of attention from fans, but they ended up losing 80 million yen on the project, which at the time, I looked this up, is like 641,000. So they worked, it was co-produced with Group TAC. Group TAC is subcontracted by Toho to create the movie. Group TAC subcontracted Gainax, and they advanced them 50 million yen, which is around 400,000, to create the project. And Takeda says, like, I think they were trying to help us out. Anno at first says, no, I'm not going to direct this. They talk him into it. And then they start making character designs. Sadamoto, who we talked about, makes new characters. They create a rough plot for the movie. But then they end up spending all 50 million yen in like these formative phases. They're not so good with money. They end up getting indicted on tax fraud later, which Takeda essentially credits to them being incompetent. But so they go to Group TAC. They're like, yeah, we can't produce this movie. Group TAC asks them, okay, where's the money? And they say, we're sorry, we spent all of it.
Group TAC is really like the unsung hero of this whole thing, because somehow they just got told that their nest egg of like hundreds of thousands of dollars just vanished.
Yeah.
And they didn't just obliterate Gainax right there on the spot. So
immediately. For real, yeah. And Gainax ends up paying them back the money after Evangelion, which was a windfall for them. And Group TAC even subtracts what they would have paid for the character designs and the footage from the show, which is really nice. So that's Group TAC takes the project and they finish it fairly quickly with a low budget. It was actually written by one of the writers of the show. So the character designs are used. The plot, you assume, is mostly used. The composer,
Shiro Sakisu.
Maybe
my
the
best friend.
Maybe the best anime composer of all time. Works on all of Eva, works on all of Anno's live action movies. He's just incredible.
He's great.
Great guy. So that's that. The plot of the movie is
anybody's guess.
So it picks up 2 to 3 years later. So Jean is now living on his own in France by the sea, working on his inventions. Nadia is now just a normal girl. She's working at a news organization as like an assistant reporter, but she's treated as essentially like an intern. They have her go get coffee. The movie starts when a bunch of world leaders start spontaneously combusting and turning into nothing and just evaporating. She starts looking into it on her own accord.
Because the system won't let her
through
the normal channel, so she's got
to
stand up.
So she gets a call from an anonymous source, and she agrees to meet with him. She meets with the source, who tells her he's a former member of the Neo-Atlantis regime who has defected, and he tells her that there is a new villain named Gigar. So he has essentially taken on the mantle of the Neo-Atlanteans, only really in, I don't even think in name, just in the symbology that he uses. And so they get pursued by two guys in trench coats who are part of this new regime. Her source gets shot and killed, and she tries to escape. Meanwhile, John finds a mysterious girl who is washed up from the sea named Fuzzy, or Faji, I think, in the Japanese. She has no memories. She keeps saying strange things like, Fuzzy is dead, all these odd things. And then Grandis and and Sanson and Hansen are now private detectives, and they come to Jean's house, seemingly not having any of the relationship they cultivated throughout the whole show.
Very weird moment. Yeah.
Very strange. We'll talk more about it. They have been told by Gigar that he has kidnapped the daughter of an important scientist named Dr. Wular, who becomes more important. So they kidnap her again. Jean pursues, finds Nadia, tries to help her escape. They get both captured by Gigar, brought onto the ship. Essentially, there's this doctor, Dr. Wular, who is making these fake human robots that run on the life source that's throughout the galaxies that created humanity or something, and that all humans consume. The robots overconsume this life force, so they just explode. So they're malfunctioning. And he's trying to replace all the world leaders with these robots so that he can start a world war. And then Fuzzy is like a robot replication of Dr. Wular's daughter, who maybe he created, but then now hates. And so he has no love for her. But as the movie progresses, she eventually tries to save him by jumping in front of a bullet. This changes his mind. He decides to take down Gigar. He brings a bomb into like the throne room and blows them all up, which is pretty cool.
pretty fucking metal.
Everything explodes, takes down the whole robot infrastructure. And sadly, Fuzzy, as one of the robots, also dies, disappears in front of them.
Very beautifully.
Yeah.
Very
little
bloodshed.
It is actually a beautiful scene.
She dissipates into the
ether. She says, I hope I'll be a real human next time. And Jean says, you already are a real human. Jean and Nadia finally kiss. And they, again, decide to go their separate ways. Because I guess at first she wanted to live on her own and not depend on Jean. And then it ends. And she's like, now I'm really going to not depend on you. And I'm going to go write a book about all of this. We do know from the end of the series, little Where Are They Now, which we won't discuss because there's some strange things in there. They get married. And that's all that really matters. So that's the movie.
If some of you were thinking when Nate was summarizing the plot and maybe going through the first third or so, you were thinking, oh, that's interesting. Sounds like a pretty classic setup to an adventure with the exposition given by the dying character and the characters meeting each other again. How long does that go for? But you know, like 10 minutes, 20 minutes. It's like 40 minutes of like footage from the show.
Yep.
Just like kind of you would assumedly think meaning to explain and like anchor the lore of the movie and the lore of the show, or like in the story of the show, so you could, maybe if you've never seen the show and you watch the movie, you know what's going on. But then the footage that they choose to put in that section that's supposed to be like a retreading of old ground just doesn't even, like, it's not even related.
It's baffling. I've been thinking about why they chose, because it jumps around everywhere. It never really explains like why or how they meet the crew of the Nautilus.
No, yeah.
Jumps over a lot of character development, and it doesn't show like the conclusion of it, like why they're now in their separate places. They kind of fill you in on that, but like you don't really get it.
It's borderline nonsensical. The only way that like cavalcade of information even makes remote sense is if you've already seen the show.
Yeah.
And you can fill in the blanks for yourself. Because like it's so nonsensical. It's not even chronological.
No, it just jumps around. And some of the scenes they decide to include, I mean, they just decide to include the aforementioned scene where Jean peeks on Nadia and Grandis changing.
Yeah.
They just include that for no reason other than fan service, I guess. Like maybe to fulfill Anno's wishes.
There has to be some level of sexualization. Another weird thing about it is that like it's structured to be kind of like flashbacks from Nadia's point of view as she's writing in her journal in the now present in the time of the movie. But then she'll give a prompt to be like, that's when I met John.
Yep.
And so the first few parts of the flashback will be clips about John. So it's like, that's sensible. And then it'll just like start giving background information on like Nemo. or yeah. like Gargoyle, yeah. or Gargoyle or something. And it's like, this isn't John. You could have easily even reused the same information to just have her do another prompt for the flashback.
Yeah.
Because this isn't, nobody's going to know what this means. Like, people right. are going to think this is still, like, did John turn into Gargoyle or something? Like, what happened?
Yeah, 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 exactly. I mean, I think, I've been thinking about this. So one of the, I think, weakest parts is how Grandis and the boys are depicted.
Yeah.
And I think the scenes they include of them, I think are like a way to establish a pretense for the characters acting in the way they do in the movie. Because they show the meeting, they show the scene we were talking about where they're pursuing Jean and Nadia in the first episode, but then you see them working together, but only like in passing. There's no, you don't really see, like, you know, you don't see Grandis's flashback and like any of the stuff that establishes them like growing as characters and like all the friendship they cultivated. Like, no, they're very close by the end.
You do see them singing happy birthday to Nadia.
Oh, true.
After she tries to off herself.
Yeah. This is a great scene,
spoiler
though.
Spoiler
alert.
This is
a powerful,
fucking awesome scene.
Yeah. Because she has never known like who she is, where she comes from. They find out her birthday. They all sing and she's like crying. It's really nice. And in this movie, like, they are just the same as they were in the beginning of the show, it feels like. There's a little bit when they come to confront Jean, you know, because they're not working for the bad guys. They think that Jean kidnapped Fuzzy, but like, they don't ask him if, like, Jean, this is, it's you? Like,
yeah,
you're
yeah.
the one who kidnapped her? She just literally says, like, you turned out to be a nasty boy. And then they take her and leave.
Yeah, it was weird. It also was like, with them being hired by a seemingly unknown, you know, beneficiary, they kind of had an out
yeah.
to give them that,
right.
that you know, reasonable doubt of like, oh, we didn't even know it was you. But like, as soon as they yeah. saw it was John, they should be like ecstatic to see him.
Exactly.
Because yeah. it's like, that's who they were at the end of the series.
Yeah.
And like, even in the epilogue, they're still friends.
Yeah. And it's strange because it's the same writer too, but who knows? I mean, they did like rush it because Gynex fucked up.
Yeah. The
so to a certain extent. And then, you know, they do find out because Gygar's henchmen try to steal Fuzzy without paying them, hold them at gunpoint. So they do end up like kind of helping out, but then they also, they're like, oh, there's all these VIPs kidnapped. We have to find them so that we can like hold them for ransom because we need money. And it's just like, is so against what their characters have become. I think Hansen, while they're looking for the VIPs, is like, I'd rather help Nadia and John. But it's just a quick line. Like, I don't know if they remembered that they were supposed to be friends, but it was very weird.
Yeah, there was not a lot of continuity. I mean, even in the show, there was like in the bad episodes, there was so...
Yeah, it was a little...
The Africa play. Stuff is like, there's an arc, for those who don't know, after the Islands arc, which is pretty atrocious, there's an arc called the Africa arc where they go to Africa, which is really weird and also has the same feeling of like somebody came in halfway through the project and didn't watch it and just started writing it.
Yeah.
But it's just like none of the characters are acting the way that they were supposed to be acting
yep.
based off of what was going on two episodes ago. And that's what a lot of this movie feels like.
Yeah.
Nadia's kind of classic because she's always difficult.
Right.
And she's just always going back and forth between like being happy and then like not.
Right. And she has a bit of a point with Fuzzy because like John does a terrible job of describing what's going on between them.
Yeah, I mean,
because she's jealous of Fuzzy, obviously, who could be an interesting character. I thought she was an interesting character, but you get not too much from her.
She's like the new addition character to the movie, so you feel like she should be getting a lot of screen time. She really doesn't get a lot
yeah.
of screen time or development, especially with her being like the kind of like archetypal golem automaton type thing. Like, there's a lot of interesting stuff you can do with that, and I feel like they just kind of yeah. were like, you know the story,
right?
She's a robot, but is she
right?
She might be human,
right?
She's not, but she could. And it's like, all right,
yeah.
Just the most interesting parts of the movie, I thought, though, were the very small bits they gave Fuzzy with her flashbacks.
I was gonna say that too. Yeah,
because her dad, to summarize a little bit, it seems like he instilled memories into her of like Fuzzy's life.
Yeah.
And then like She couldn't do things like she couldn't blow out her candles because I guess robots don't breathe. And then he got like yeah. really angry at her.
But and he wants her to like sing. And this isn't a flashback. She has these like hallucinatory flashbacks
She's tripping the whole time.
Which are she's really good.
Yeah.
The animation is quite good. Fantastic.
I wouldn't say it's like fantastic. It was better than anything else in the movie.
Yeah, for sure. Like there are moments, it reminds me of Nadia also has these like dreams in the show. Yeah. Reminded me of those. And I mean, there's some like complex animation going on where like characters are morphing into other characters and like it's really smooth and it's, yeah, it's really well done. I mean, it's more minimal as well. So maybe it's a little easier to do that. But those were like very visually appealing. I mean, I thought that was great.
And efficient too. Yeah. I thought it didn't seem like they had a lot of time to deal with considering so much of the movie gets eaten up by like borrowed footage from the show.
There was room for more interesting stuff because there are some interesting elements. And I think a lot of the problem with the movie is that they don't dive into it as much as they could.
Well, but again, or as much as they were even like allowed to fiscally, it seems like there was so many limitations on it.
That's probably why they use so much footage too, is that Gainax was like, yeah, so we spent all the money and so here's a story outline and oh, here's a new character that Sadamoto designed. Bring her into this.
I really thought if we just gambled well, that 50 million yen could be 250 so easily. I just, if it hit double zero, we'd be in the green.
Basically, yeah. It is funny. So you can't blame them too much, but there is some interesting stuff in here. And I think Fuzzy's stuff is really interesting, although it's like, it's unclear like what the deal with her is, because I think you see, so the defector who turns into the informant, you see like him taking Fuzzy away because the doctor is like, I don't want her anymore. She can't even remember the song she used to sing on her birthday all the time. And I think in the vision, you see like the defector pulling her away with like a evil smile. So we don't know what's going on.
I'm not sure if it was evil or...
It's a smile, I suppose.
Does it actually say... I think he was just taking her away either evilly or because he felt bad, but he seemed like he wasn't that bad of a guy. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, because he did defect and like give the information.
I think we should talk about the villain.
Yes,
because he's just hilarious. I love the villain. Yeah.
He is really fucking funny.
He looks like a pimple. He looks like a skeleton with a pimple for a head. The funny/interesting aspect of the funniness of it is that he like, you can kind of read it like he's like this horrible blundering imitation of Gargoyle.
Yeah.
Which I think if it was intentional, they should have leaned into more.
Yeah.
Because it's like, so the whole setup is the robots.
Yeah.
And then he has all these grunts working for him. Who are just kind of like...
They're all like former Neo-Atlanteans who like didn't know what to do with themselves after Gargoyle was defeated.
Right. But it seems almost like because of the robot thing, I kind of assume because so many of those henchmen were like kind of without personality and kind of just following orders, I was like, oh, they're robots.
Right.
It turns out that they're people and they're like relentlessly loyal to this guy
who's
never had a single win. And every time something goes wrong, he just shoots at least one or two people. Yeah. So like, there's nothing that's justifying this undying loyalty. No. And they're all, it's almost like this cosmic horror thing where they're like fated to just serve this guy until they get shot to death.
Yeah.
It's so funny.
There's a really good moment when the doctor goes in with the bomb where he tries to use one of the henchmen, seems like an important part of the like team, as a human shield, and he just shoots right through her. It's like he is so over the top, and his whole thing is like, I just hate humanity, so I want there to be a world war and just everybody to fuck each other up.
But his plan is even weirder because he's like, there's going to be a world war in a few years, but I just want there to be a world war sooner. Like he's already, because it takes place in like, it's got to be like 1903 at this point or something. I think the original series takes place in like 1898.
No, I think
it's
still in the 18.
I think it's 1889. I didn't write
it
down, actually.
But it is still like in the 80s. Okay. Yeah, but it might be 89. Yeah.
So, but he's saying like there's going to be a world war soon.
Yeah.
But he's saying like it's just human nature to fight wars. So, like, there's going to be one. It's inevitable. And he's like, it's not soon enough.
Yeah.
I need it to be my war that I start. Because it's so weird. He's like, I need to replace all these VIPs and politicians so that they do this war that they're already going to do.
Yeah.
But I need to do this convoluted plan that isn't working and is constantly shedding resources
right.
and bumbling. I mean, presumably his plan is to take over with those VIP robots after the war is done or something.
Right, yeah.
But it's so funny that it's just like such a terrible plan.
Yeah. Because like the doctor can't even do it. He's like, yeah, I'm not capable of making these robots.
Yeah, that was I think that was my favorite part of the movie was like the legitimately good and like funny reveal that because it's set up as like the inciting incident to the whole thing is that politicians are disappearing.
Right.
So you're like, oh, this like the space laser. It's got to be like an invisible space laser. Yeah. And he's going to start taking people hostage saying like, I'll vaporize anybody or something.
Right.
And then it's revealed that they're being vaporized because they've already been replaced. And those were the robots that are just so poorly put together that they're just breaking down. And so there's this whole bumbling operation of trying to like constantly replace these same robots.
Right. Yeah. And like, I don't know if this was just bad writing or what the deal was, but Gigar like has Fuzzy as like a hostage, but the doctor like doesn't give a fuck about her. So they like put all this effort to getting her back and he like parades her into the room and he was like, if you don't complete this plan, I'm going to pick her apart piece by piece. And the doctor's just like, okay.
Yeah.
Dude, okay. I guess that's not going to make me make these robots any faster. This is like impossible.
Yeah.
So I don't know if it's just like the villain is just so incompetent that he's like, I'll use this classic scheme of the hostage and like thinks that's so important. But he's like, the doctor's been like, I've been telling you, I don't care about this robot.
He's so consistently bumbling that you feel like it has to be on purpose that he's written that way.
Yeah.
But then at the same time,
I think so.
At the same time, they like don't, I feel like they don't lean into it enough. Like it could be his main thing.
Right.
Like not like gags constantly, but like, you know, I mean, there's some interesting things to be said for horribly incompetent people getting insane amounts of power. And blind loyalty, for, you know, that's a thing you could talk about for sure.
I think that's what it was.
Yeah, but like, it's not that fleshed out.
No, I mean like, you have 40 minutes to flesh it out.
It is insane. I really do want to reiterate just for the audience that we're really not exaggerating that almost half this movie is just flashbacks.
Yeah.
It's at least a third.
We were both worried it was going to go longer.
That it was just going to be the whole thing.
Yeah. Because they do, I think twice, where like Nadia's looking out a window, like a store window or something. And she's like, I remember my time with Jean. And then it cuts back. She's in her bedroom. And then she's like, my time with Jean. And then it cuts back again.
Yeah, by the second one, you're like, no, don't say it.
I can't take any more of this. But so the World War thing I've been thinking about. And I think if I'm going to take this movie on its face and try to do like a genuine analysis, maybe there is a commentary. So when the villain says, well, you can't stop me because there's going to be a world war in like the next 15 to 20 years anyway, all of the characters are like, that's crazy. Like the entire world going to war is like nuts. There's no way that's going to happen. You're crazy. You're incompetent. All this stuff. And as we know, there was a world war, in fact. And I think maybe there's like some sort of commentary on the absurdity of evil. The fact that this villain is so over the top, so ridiculous that his scheme is to make the world go to war with itself. And yet that just naturally happened anyway. Without this wacky sci-fi premise, it's like, just watching it straight up, you're like, this is a crazy scheme. But it's like, no, the world just went to war anyway without all of this. And like, also arguably with incompetence involved.
World War I is like the epitome of incompetent warfare and like incompetence leading to warfare.
Right. People still like debate about what even started it. Like there's the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand. Yeah, I don't know a lot about the history, but I know people still debate it.
I think people are largely like mostly in agreement that it was the preamble and the unification of Germany and like some of the old shit that Prussia got up to. Basically, like the Austro-Hungarian Empire was not very nice to Serbia. I forget how they were unified with the other powers that they were unified with, but France hated Germany. because of some old stuff that they were got up to with, especially with Alsace-Lorraine and some of the wars that they got into in the 1860s, I think.
Yeah.
And then basically a lot of alliances formed around that. The Ferdinand getting assassinated by Serbians, Austria-Hungary invaded Serbia, and then Russia was like, you can't do that. We like Serbia. And then it was like, wait a minute. We had an agreement with France against Germany. I think France and Russia were teamed up against Germany because everybody hated Germany. It's really weird.
Well, so with that then, okay, I think we can agree that the Neo-Atlanteans, there's a lot of like Nazi,
oh, yeah,
echoing
for
Nazis.
Sure. Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, it's like straight up fascism.
And Jean is French. I might be stretching here, but I'm trying to just take it on its face. Maybe there was a good story outline here. And like you were saying, like a lot of the conflicts of World War One came about because of these old conflicts that in some ways have nothing to do with like the current conflicts. It's just sort of this loyalty. And you see that same loyalty with the same symbology with this new Gigar crew, but the ideology isn't really the same. There's just this loyalty to this empire or this like country that they still have, even though there's not a direct relation there. So I wonder if there is like some sort of commentary there.
You could definitely make the argument that it kind of mimics like the idea of like the Third Reich.
Yeah.
And the idea of like Aryans.
Right.
Considering Aryans weren't white. And the Third Reich had nothing to do with the First or the Second Reich.
Right, exactly. Exactly. It's like this is the next iteration using the same like symbols and like pretense, but it's completely different. It's just like pure evil for the sake of evil.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think there is something there. I was trying to think like if there is like a real message in this movie and like why they made the decisions. And it still does feel slapped together, obviously. And like, you know, they finish it fairly quickly. But maybe there's something at the core there, that there is like a commentary.
I think if they had the time and weren't so marred down by production, like this is like clearly egregiously marred down by production. Whereas all films have deadlines and constraints. But this is like worst case.
Yeah.
It seems like.
Group TAC being like, well, Gynex is working on it, so we're fine.
Yeah.
And then they come back. They're like, not only can we not finish it, we don't have your money anymore.
It's interesting, too, because I wish that the book that you sent me went into more detail or just more info was available really about like the nature of Group TAC.
Yeah.
And like that deal, because Group TAC is really intriguing to me. And like, I don't even know if they, I mean, obviously they had their own animation department, but they clearly weren't expecting to even work on the movie.
Yeah.
In respects to animating it. So it's like, how much did they have to scrape together just something, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
and it seems like with what they were given, they did a decent job. And I mean, it shows with all the filler and some of the animation is bad, where it's like from a distance, like the faces are all fucked up and like all
still
this stuff.
Not as bad as Africa.
True.
Africa's still worse.
True. There is like a silver lining in Africa, though, I think.
No.
they try to pull it together. Because in the show, Nadia like randomly falls in love with this like prince or something in Africa.
I remember,
right after like getting close to Jean, and it's like really jarring and upsetting.
Like at the end of the first real climax of the first season that we talked about earlier, their character growth was so successful, but there was the seeds of doubt sown with her because she's kind of starting to understand who she is in relation to Atlantis and all that stuff. But basically, finally, the climax of the island arc comes, and it's like the way that they bring Nadia and Jean together is finally, there's the kind of the subtext also in the whole thematic thing of like finding maturity and John and Nadia wanting to become real adults. Like John literally explicitly says during the Nautilus arc that he's going to now try and like understand being an adult sincerely. And it's interesting in the way that make that coincide with both of their character development and their development as, you know, two characters, obviously with a relationship to each other is really good. And then in the end of the island arc, when she emerges from the machine, deciding that she, you know, cares very much for John, and she's nude, right? And he embraces her, and they don't even mention that she's nude.
I was going to mention that, too.
And it's beautiful.
Such a beautiful moment.
Especially because earlier in the series, you've had the fan service-y gags of him seeing her fanning herself and revealing some, like, underboob or whatever, or, like, changing. And you have those kind of vapid things. And here's this moment of like real intimacy.
Yeah.
That's very much is said without being said. And then you go right into Africa.
Yeah.
And I remember my blood pressure just like spiking.
I know. Cause it's, that is such like a beautiful and like pivotal moment for the two of them.
Yep.
And it just is pulled out. And like the way they tried to pull it back together is Nadia's like, I was being fucking crazy. You know, I am in love with you, obviously, like getting you back to the character development that had already happened.
Yeah.
Because they needed these bullshit episodes. And there's the whole thing, too, with Grandis. So as we talked about, there was the whole her like husband was scheming her out of the money. He turns out to just be around and he's in Africa. And then she just like falls in love with him again. And it's again, there's like some good stuff because she does end up, she kind of gets herself out of it, right?
I think she was just hoping she would. I think she takes revenge on him like after the fact, but I think she's largely like rescued by John and Sanson and Hansen, I think.
Yeah.
Which is like insulting to her character.
For sure.
Completely, because like, it's so interesting how they set her up with her character too, with her motivation, because she's introduced as like the jewel thief and this kind of femme fatale-ish, like, you know, putting herself and her crew before everything else and like being kind of bossy to them and controlling. And then you kind of understand that it comes from this place of vulnerability because she lost her family's entire fortune, you know, and is now trying to like prove her worth by gaining it back through kind of like any means necessary. And so that justifies her any means necessary and kind of curt, cold nature.
Yeah.
And then they throw it all away.
Yeah.
And I was like,
yeah, they just really, and then the conclusion is awesome. And I don't know, I love Grandis's character so much. And like, that's part of why I was so disappointed with how her and Sanson and Hansen were treated in this, because it's just like, all right, again, the character development is like gone again. And we have to, and they kind of come back to where they were, but it's, you know, they just kind of play a secondary role and they're kind of like, oh, what can we have these kooky characters do now? Oh, they're private eyes now because they're still searching for money. It's just kind of whack.
It was weird because by the end of the show, they're like main characters.
Yeah.
With real arcs.
Yeah. All of them like have like strong characters to them. And it's, and then you learn to love them. And that's great with Sanson and Hansen too, because they're just, you know, even the names of like Sanson and Hansen. It's like, oh, the two henchmen. But they end up having their, both have their whole characters.
I love
and, like,
them so much.
They're awesome. Yeah. They're so awesome. But so that kind of sucked. Although when they crash the, I forget what it's called, but their vehicle in this, it's because they're like listening to Nadia and John, right?
Yeah.
Which I love that. That's like a thing throughout this series is that they're all really invested in John and Nadia's relationship.
Yeah.
And they like crash their submarine in this because they were like eavesdropping on them, which is really funny. And I do love that about their characters. And that was consistent that they just like love John and Nadia and want to like see them together.
Yeah.
So, but again, you know, then it like, why were they so harsh against John
earlier?
It doesn't make any sense.
It's literally, I know this is kind of like sacrilege in terms of like the continuity of any shows, but I kind of have warmed up to the idea of just like discounting some things as not canon when I don't like them.
For sure.
Because if the writing is so bad that it does break character continuity, it might as well be non-canon.
Yeah,
so
definitely.
I'm just going to call it non-canon.
Definitely. Let's hit some positives though. So I think, I think the themes, like I said, I think there was some interesting stuff with the themes of it. And there were some really great moments of animation. I was saying this while we were watching it. They have these fucking awesome transitions between scenes where like one object becomes another object and then you're placed in a new scene. One of the first ones, Nadia's like looking out her window and sees like a bird and the bird takes off. It flies into the air. Then as it's flying its arc, it turns into like a paper airplane and then comes back down to Earth and you see that Jean is there and he just threw it through the airplane. It's this like seamless transition where it goes up to the sky and the, you know, bird becomes a plane. It comes back down and you're somewhere else. There's a few of those. I'm forgetting what the other ones were, but they were really good.
Yeah, I think the editing was noticeably better than most other aspects of the movie.
Yeah.
Like where it made it explicitly noticeable. I don't know if it's technically a flashback, but when we first see, I think Fuzzy's like one of her first scenes and she gets kind of like overwhelmed.
Yeah.
And it shows it turning between her dad and Gygar and the guy who saved her. And then like it's, you know, It's a really good way of conveying the sense of like fear and anxiety about that. That was great. Definitely felt like the editing was more intentional than a lot of the other aspects of it, for sure. Where it felt like some other aspects were just kind of like, it seemed like there was a different person on the job that day. Seemed like the editing was mostly consistent.
True. It was consistently good, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, with the low budget and stuff, it kind of seemed like they picked their battles with what moments were well animated. Because they're clearly talented with like the good stuff you see. Yeah. But you know, it was nice to see Jean and Nadia again. You know, I just do love them so much. So like, even though a lot of this movie wasn't great, there's something about just seeing your old friends again that I really like overall, like kind of left me with a positive impression. I didn't, you know, when we were done watching it, I wasn't like, oh, that was such a bad movie. I was like, it wasn't great, but
I think we both went into it knowing what it was likely going to be too. Cause we knew a lot of the background of it.
Yeah.
And also we knew it was like direct to DVD, which doesn't usually bode well.
Yeah. For VHS things. At the time. Or VHS, probably. Yeah.
I didn't think at any point that I had to like turn it off or anything. It wasn't bad like that. The only part that I got worried was when the flashback was so significantly long.
Yeah.
And it's like, I remember just being like, wow, the footage from the show is fun. Kind of makes me want to watch the show and not this movie.
Oh, I forgot that scene. Kind of want to see the context around it. So I guess since we're nearing the end of the episode, the announcement is that we will be finally doing a review episode of End of Evangelion, which I think we both agree is a perfect movie, right?
It's been in my top like three movies since I've watched it years ago.
For anybody who hasn't seen it, like, I mean, even if you're not a huge anime fan, it's worth a watch. If you are an anime fan, why haven't you watched this?
You really need to love it. It's one of those things that,
if you don't,
most movies or shows, even the ones that I hold in like the highest regard, like if I tried to sell like The Sopranos to somebody and they were like, I don't really like crime TV, I'd be like, yeah, you'll hate The Sopranos.
Yeah, right.
But if someone's like, Evangelion isn't my cup of tea, I'm just going to be like, you're wrong. Like, you need to watch it and like it. Like, I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah.
Like, it can't not be your cup of tea because it's just about like, at the end of the day, it's about just like existence and being human.
Yeah. We both have so much to say. I'm sure it's going to be a very long episode.
It's going to
be years. There's not going to be much I can cut either. It's going to be really good.
Fuck it. Make it 4 hours long. I don't
even
care.
It might be.
Might be. If there's anything I can give a dissertation on, it's Evangelion.
Exactly. I mean, as you know, I've written like two essays on it. Like it is.
I'll promise it now. I will read your essay for the episode.
Okay. That's on the air.
It's on the air. It's on the air.
I'm insanely excited.
Yes. I'm excited to see it in fucking theaters.
I know.
I've only seen it the one time.
Yeah.
In theaters.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we were so lucky to be able to even watch it like that. But
yeah.
I was looking at the show, looking at like the seats. It's like essentially sold out.
Nice.
And it's going to be all Ava fans. And it's like, there's such a different experience there. And it's, with the sound and everything too, it's just going to be...
It's going to be popping.
Something else.
As the kids say.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you guys for listening. It's fucking great to be back at it. I'm glad we finally got back in these episodes. We're older, wiser, smarter. Hope that is conveyed.
Talking the talk.
So, thank you so much for listening, and thank you to any new viewers, listeners. You can follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, anywhere that there are podcasts streaming. That helps us a lot with getting eyes on our podcast, just the follow, ratings. You can also follow us on Instagram. It's at TalkieTalkCast. Oh, yeah. We also have an email. You can email me at TalkieTalkCast@gmail.com. If you have any thoughts on the episodes or if you have any film recommendations,
social security numbers,
any credit cards, we'll take anything. Feel free to reach out. We love hearing from you. We never have, but actually,
that's not true. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, we did. Yeah. We should do that movie.
The war movie, the tank movie or whatever.
Yeah. Somebody reached out to us years ago being like, nobody's heard of this movie. I need you guys to watch it.
We should do that.
So maybe we'll do that. But somebody actually DM'd us on Instagram recently and they were like, hey, just discovered the podcast. I'm really loving it. Keep it up, guys. So that was really nice. Yeah, that's awesome. So thank you to that listener.
If you want a shout out, tell us.
Oh, yeah.
And we will. You're so great, though.
Yeah. So thank you guys again for listening. And please do tune in next week for the greatest Talkie Talk episode ever. So
I'm psyched.
Yeah, I'm really excited. I really can't wait. All right, guys. Thanks again.
Woo.
We'll see you next week.
Go watch Nadia. It's worth it. And Ava.